Welcome to From the Roots Up. This is Sean Frame. I'm your host. And each week we take a look at an issue that's important to all of us from the ground up, not from the top down. It's real easy to be wondering about issues in this world and look for places to find legitimate information that can help you understand it and understand your way into it, a way to make things better. But those things are hard to find. You know, when you go to a regular media outlets, often you get a very thin or shallow look at an issue. Often there is just one side presented, and then they move on, and leave you wondering, you know, wow, how can I make things better? The whole point of this show is to take these issues, look at them more in depth than you will get anywhere else, and also look at how that interfaces in each of our lives, and then talk about what we can do. Because look, in the world we live in, the number of just hard things we hear every day, things that are difficult to take in, things that upset us, make us feel like this world is falling apart. And then we're often just left with this point of view that like, there's not much you can do about it. Sorry. I guess just that's the way it is. I just don't accept that. The way I think about the world is that we are our nation. We are our democratic republic. We are the people who can affect the change. We just need to understand how things work and where we fit. And so that's what we're doing. In case you don't know who I am, my name is Sean Frame. I was a school board member in Placerville for 9 years. I've run for high office a couple of times. I work in education, actually. And, so I do have a lot of information and perspective on the education issue. And that's what we're going to take on today. I hear lots of things out in the world, and often I just find myself shaking my head, because in those 9 years that I served on the school board, I spent a lot of time digging in and getting to know every last detail of public education, because I take things seriously. You know, when I took on that role of being a school board member, I didn't just think it was sufficient to bring my experience as a business owner, for example, into it, which I did, of course, or the, you know, ideological perspectives I had as somebody who had been out in the world for decades, encountering lots of different things, right? What I thought I needed to do was understand the system inside and out, how it worked, how it served students and families, and then move forward with policy, with decision making. And so that's what I did. And, you know, we're actually going to dig in deep on our public school system and then talk about, you know, where you fit, where we all fit, and what we can do. Later today, we're going to have interviews with people who have direct experience working in schools, understanding education policy, and discussing the current state of public education in our state and our nation. But let's go into why this is important to me. I raised two sons in our public schools. And what I mean by raise them in our public schools is meaning, you know, when your child goes to school every day, whether they start in preschool or whether they, you know, start in kindergarten, they are at school for a big portion of their day. And we are, you know, sort of raising them together. And do I mean that, you know, the school is raising my children? Absolutely not. But there is an influence there. It is where they get their information, their knowledge, their understanding of the world, the things that will be foundational for them as they go forward in their life. So there is a component of partnership there. I will say this, you know, they're both adults now, and the public education they got here in California was excellent, and it gave them the preparation they needed to move on. Is it perfect? Absolutely not, but it was good. It was really good. And, you know, part of that's because, you know, of the advantages they had having myself and their mom and others in their life who, you know, were there for them. Right. That's very important in determining outcomes for children. But also, I will say that, you know, the education system was structured in such a way that they could find their way through it. They could find things they were interested in. They could explore those things. They could help determine what their life might look like, what things they might want to pursue when they were adults, and they could go after it in their public school system. And that's, to me, the opportunity we should be giving to every single child residing in our state and our nation. Children are 100% innocent of the situation they find themselves in. And when I say situation, I mean who they're born to, where they live, what's going on in their life, what's going on in their community. They are there and they deserve the best that we can give them. If we are going to survive as a society and even as a species, we need to be giving our children every chance to reach their full potential in life. I will say that the reason I ended up on the school board really wasn't, it was never something I imagined I would do. I had a business and I was plenty busy with that and raising children. And then, my son Everett was at school in second grade. His principal was shot and killed during the school day at his school. His school was locked down. This traumatized, every single student at the school and every staff member and every member of the community who had any, contact and knowledge of that school. And, I helped serve on the committee of parents that would start helping to rebuild our school community and find a new leader to run the school and be the solid person that his predecessor had been. And out of that experience, I ended up taking a leadership role and I was asked to join the school board. And at that moment, when our community needed me most to step up, I couldn't say no. And that's why I served on a school board. And that's why, as I discussed earlier, I really took it seriously because I felt it was the legacy of my friend who had lost his life doing nothing more than serving public children in a public elementary school. So I served on that school board for 9 years. And as I said earlier, I really dug in and studied and learned the issues. And I recognized that our opportunity in public education was nothing short of the transformation of people's prospects in life. I'm going to say that again. Public education is the opportunity to transform the prospects of people's lives. And I can tell you, in the school district, when I walked in there where my sons went to school, aside from the tragedy that had happened, I would have looked at that school and told you that students were, living great lives and everybody had a modicum of, a home and a home life and food that they needed and everything. And then once I dug in, I realized no, that's not actually true. At that time, 100 students in that district of 1,300 students were homeless at any given moment. 100 of them. We had the center for where people could come and get resources right on the campus. And yet I was unaware of that until I was on the school board. We had, a good 60-70% of our students receiving free and reduced lunch. And by the time I left, we had just gone to the state program that allowed it to be 100%. So there was no longer a stigma attached to being food insecure, being hungry when you arrive at school. These were things I didn't know. But once I learned them, I could never look at my job as a school board member the same way I thought I did when I walked in. So as we move through this show, I definitely want to talk about, the current state of public education, a lot of the mythology that I sort of uncovered as a school board member. I want to talk with, of course, the experts and hear their perspective on what's happening right up to the minute, since I haven't served on a school board for a little while. And then from that point, I'm going to we'll really dig into where you fit, how you can make a difference, whether you have children in the school or not. Just if you have an interest in public education, how you can get involved to make our public schools better. When we come back, we're going to look at the myths first. We're going to look at the myth that first, our schools are failing students. They are not. Spoiler alert. We're going to look at the myth that charter or private schools are needed to fill the gaps left by public education. That, too, is a myth that has been exploded. And I want to dig into that a little further. And the third myth is that vouchers would give parents the choice to move their kids to the best schools, leaving lesser schools to fail in the marketplace. First of all, I want to get into why that's absolutely a myth, why it's bad for our body politic and our world and our children and our students and our families. And also really want to talk about this notion that schools should be allowed to fail. I just think that's an absolutely insane notion that some folks have regarding our public education system. So we'll be getting to all that when we get back right after this break.
To make a mountain of your life is just a choice, but I never learned enough to listen to the voice that told me always love. Hate will get you every time, always love. Don't wait till the finish line.
If you love live music and want to be up close and personal with the band, there's only one place to go, the Torch Club. This hotspot is the place to be with two shows a day, Wednesday to Sunday. Check out the upcoming shows at torchclub.net or just drop by 904 15th Street in Sacramento. The Torch Club. There's always something happening. Come celebrate our 25 years at this location, April 11th to 13th. From the Roots Up is brought to you by The Six Pack. Crack open some change and support the candidates and causes we need in these times. Paid for by The Six Pack, which is responsible for the content of this advertising. www.thesixpack.com. Not authorized by any candidate or candidates committee. We're talking about public education today, and really, like, this is a subject that is just such, become such a passion for me. It really, you know, once I started serving on a school board, you know, I saw quickly that I really wanted to make this my life's work. And so now I actually work in public education. So full disclosure, you know, if you're wondering like why I'm so passionate about public education, it's not just that I served on a school board for 9 years, it's that I actually have really changed what I do in my life to be a part of the public education system. But, you know, one of the things that always really gets me upset is the myths that are out there about our public education system. And it's time to really look at some of these and break it down, explore them thoroughly and debunk them, because they are, I'm calling them myths because they are myths. The first myth that I hear all the time is that the education system in the United States of America and in California are broken. And that's just simply not true. You know, often it's like we're compared to, you know, the Norway or Denmark or, you know, some of the quote top performing countries in the world unfavorably. And that's, you know, it's like on the surface, it seems like, oh, yeah, well, America is really lagging behind other, you know, wealthy nations on Earth in terms of the way we educate our children, unless you control for socioeconomic status. And then if you look at the education system for our wealthiest folks, we actually are at the very top. We're right there with all of the other countries who have, quote, the best education systems out there. Where we fail is you know, the students that are down the socioeconomic scale at the middle or at the bottom. And that's really sort of a stark difference from other countries where their people pretty much by and large are getting a similar educational experience. Whereas here in the United States, if you look around, you'll see that, you know, students who attend schools in the wealthiest parts of our states and our nation are doing fantastic. It's everyone else is suffering. So, you know, go to Palo Alto, for example, or Marin County, and you're going to walk into schools that have every possible program available. They have small class sizes. They have student aids. They have technology that is current and up to date. Every last thing that would prepare a student for living in the modern world is available to those students. And also when they leave their school, it's available in their home. So the big difference the United States seems to have in our education system is the great disparity of socioeconomic status that doesn't exist in most other wealthy nations. So, you know, that's, if we want to make our schools better, we actually have to make our society better, our communities better. And, you know, this is something that is within our power to do. And while we're working on that larger project, we should be focusing on how do we improve the schools of our middle class and lower socioeconomic status students to bring them to comparability with folks who have have started with more just by virtue of their birth, right? The luck of the parents being more well off. Well, I think that should be the entire focus. And let's be clear. I mean, if our public schools were more equitable in their funding, they would be able to provide the services needed for our students. And let's be clear, you know, students who live in a lower socioeconomic status, students are housing insecure, students are food insecure. They have greater hurdles to cross before they even walk into the classroom. So we need to address those concerns too, the outside world being brought in. I mean, we should be working on both projects at once. How do we create an outside world where people are not food insecure and housing insecure, particularly our children? And how do we then, while we're working on that, how do we address those concerns when students walk into schools? And, you know, there have been, you know, changes made on this. Our funding formula in California provides extra funding to schools that have larger populations of foster youth, for example, of folks who are learning the English language, of folks who are low socioeconomic status. Those schools get additional funding on top of the base funding that they get. Is it enough to make their funding equivalent to schools in wealthier neighborhoods that have a higher tax base and also have wealthy people who can contribute to their local schools? No, but it does. It has helped. And there is evidence out there to show that the increased focus on providing resources to schools that needed those resources, to student populations that need those resources, does yield better outcomes. The other part of it is that, you know, we for example, are solving some of the other issues that students who are, you know, coming from a less advantageous situation in life, those challenges that they face and that they bring into the classroom. So whether you talk about trauma-informed practices, understanding the outside trauma that students are walking into the classroom with, for example, if they you know, regularly see shootings in their neighborhood, right? They're walking in with a level of trauma that needs to be de-escalated so that they're capable of learning. If they are food insecure or housing insecure, making sure that they have meals and meals that they can take home even at night makes an enormous difference in their ability to learn and actually take advantage of the education system. And then, of course, making sure that housing resources are connected to the school community to make sure that families who are housing insecure know where they can get the resources to make sure they have stable housing for their families. These things do make a huge difference in terms of the way students achieve and perform in their schools. This episode of From the Roots Up is brought to you by The Torch Club, Sacramento's premier live music venue every Wednesday to Sunday. Check them out at 904 15th Street in Sacramento or online at torchclub.net. We all know that money spent on politicians is nothing more than a bribe. Citizens United called it free speech, but we know better. But what if we could balance the scale a few bucks at a time? That's what we're doing at the Six Pack, taking small donations and adding them up to make things more fair. Crack open some change. Support the Six Pack. Paid for by the Six Pack, which is responsible for the content of this advertising. www.thesixpack.com. Not authorized by any candidate or candidates committee. So let's talk about the next myth that really just gets me worked up. This myth is one of the most pervasive ones of the last couple of decades. And it's this myth that charter and private schools are needed to fill the gaps left by traditional public schools. And I'll just say, you know, this has been largely debunked. Now that charters have been around for a couple of decades, we actually have data to back up, to you know, analyze and look and see, are charters doing a better job by our students or are they not? And the numbers are in. And basically what we've found is that charters do about the same job as their public standard public education counterparts in providing a quality education to students. Now, are there specialized charter programs that provide educational opportunities beyond what are in our traditional schools? Yes, that is true. However, there is no reason that those additional educational opportunities could not be brought into the four walls of a traditional educational environment if the funding was there. And, you know, what happens when charter schools come in and to fill these gaps is that they really, for the most part, do a very unequal job of providing those additional educational opportunities to folks. Now, why are that? Why would that be? Well, think about it for a second. If you were a working class person who's just trying to keep a roof over your family's head, and you're working one and a half or two even jobs, and maybe both folks in the family are working more than one job or at least one full-time job, this leaves little time for the kind of investigation that you would be required to do to find charter schools that would be suitable for your children, right? It's just going to be, it's just logical to think that folks whose life situation requires them to spend a lot of their time working and earning a living don't have the same time and resources available to do the investigation that, say, a single wage family might have, where one of the partners or one of the parents would have the opportunity to do this kind of investigation and research. And so what happens is, disproportionately, the students that go to charter schools are students that, would likely have done fine in the public school setting to begin with because they had the supports at home. They were in one of those more socioeconomically advantaged communities, and they had, typically families with higher incomes and higher education attainment levels. So, you know, it's kind of like the charter schools often are giving greater advantage to people who already had greater advantage. It's not lifting people up. Now, are there charter schools that have been designed specifically with the sort of, you know, underserved communities in mind? Yes. And, you know, obviously, that's a great idea to make sure that people who are being underserved by our public schools receive that kind of same kind of, you know, treatment as others. However, you know, the numbers are in, and what we can say without even hesitation is that on the whole, those schools don't do any better than their adjacent public schools. So rather than splitting the amount of money that goes into public schools or even taking the sort of, you know, cream of the crop of the student population in a public school and moving it over to a charter school, leaving the public school with, you know, the students that may have greater challenges, our foster youth, our English language learners, our low socioeconomic students, we ought to be keeping everybody together and providing a full and robust education program in the four walls of those schools, including additional opportunities for things like Montessori or even, you know, specialized sports programs. Like, these things could all happen in our public schools if they were well-funded. And I'll just say this, you know, for those underserved communities, particularly our Black students, and Black and Brown students, but, you know, really Black students, since we in California, for example, no longer are allowed to collect data based on race, we really haven't been able to understand whether or not our public schools have been doing a proper job of serving these communities that were traditionally underserved. And that is very problematic. But instead of pulling money out of our regular public schools to create specialized charter schools, what we ought to be doing is overturning that law that prevents us from collecting the data and making sure that additional funding is put to the places it is needed, and make sure that our underserved populations are populations that are more likely to be, for example, given a suspension or an expulsion at our schools, that those places are funded at a higher level to create equity in our education system. Pulling money out into specialized programs, creating additional administrative costs, for example, does not do what we would want it to do. And the numbers are in, and they prove it. But what about private schools, you say? Well, I mean, private schools often, you know, they're all over the map, right? You can go to a private school, as my wife did, and you can, you know, one of the best schools in the region, and you can achieve a lot. And folks who went to that school have gone on to achieve quite a bit. However, you know, there is nothing that prevents those schools from also doing a terrible job, right? And you think, well, what about the marketplace? Well, sometimes people are sending their kids to those schools for reasons that are unrelated to their educational attainment. They're sending them to schools because of cultural or religious requirements that they have for their family. And that means that educationally, those schools may or may not do the same or better job than their public counterparts. And when, of course, people are removing their students and putting them into private schools, it undermines both the public schools and doesn't necessarily guarantee that the students who are at the whim of their parents are getting a better education. I'm not saying that their parents shouldn't have some say in their values education. I firmly believe that they should, and I certainly did a lot to raise my sons with values that I hold dear. But I always felt like that was on me, right? It was on me to make sure that those values were instilled. And I didn't, you know, think that it was necessarily the role of public education to choose one set of values or one religious perspective and present that as the only way to live to students of a multitude of ethnicities and cultural backgrounds and religious backgrounds. It just doesn't make sense in the kind of society we live in to advantage one group over another or to prioritize the needs of one group over another. Private schools can do that, but it's real hit or miss in terms of the educational attainment that their students receive. And that leads me to the third myth, which I think we really need to get to. And this myth is becoming more and more common, and it's even being enacted in some states. This myth that vouchers are the way to give parents their rights back, to make sure that they can use their tax dollars to have the kind of education that they want for their children. Now, on the surface, that sounds like a great idea, right? Just take the money that would have gone to a public school and allow parents to pick any school they want with that money. And maybe, you know, send in, you know, bills and get them reimbursed for homeschool costs. That all sounds pretty fantastic until you realize that, you know, it's not necessarily fair. And why? Well, we've seen what happens in these programs. Arizona actually in 2022 put in a voucher program. And everybody was very excited. Oh, this is finally going to be the opportunity for parents to, you know, really get their tax dollars used in a way that they found that they thought was right for their children. What happened, however, in practice was, though the voucher program was estimated to cost $65 million, it cost over $330 million. And what were those expenses that were being used, that were being reimbursed by taxpayer dollars? Oh, it was, you know, season lift tickets for skiing for kids who were being homeschooled and, you know, wanted to have skiing as part of their educational experience. It, you know, included lots and lots of people who could afford every part of the educational experience that they were giving their children, using their access to the system, using their time, their wealth, their relative understanding of how this new voucher law worked, to drain the treasury of the state of Arizona, taking Arizona from a surplus to a deficit in a single year. And really, this money went almost exclusively to folks who had money. They didn't need additional tax dollars to provide these opportunities for their kids. But they were smart enough to know that once the voucher system was in, they could get their hands on that money and put it back in their pocket and back in their bank accounts. This also, by the way, leaving public schools with less funding and a state that's budget was broken. So if your student was, you know, if you couldn't afford the time and the money to drive your student across town to a private school and then submit for a voucher, which is a lot of working class folks, you just didn't get to use the voucher program. And what happened as a result of it? Your public school got worse because there was less funding left for the students who were left in the public schools, left behind. So I'll just say this. Those three myths, you know, have been roundly dispelled. Up next, we're going to talk with a local education expert and entrepreneur with a focus on our youth. If you love live music and want to be up close and personal with the band, there's only one place to go, the Torch Club. This hotspot is the place to be with two shows a day, Wednesday to Sunday. Check out the upcoming shows at torchclub.net or just drop by 904 15th Street in Sacramento. The Torch Club,
there's always something happening.
Come celebrate our 25 years at this location, April 11th to 13th.
All right, welcome everybody. I am here with J. Ross Pirelli, and we're going to talk about a lot of things today. But I just want to—I got to go through the whole list of amazing things you do. You're on the Placer County Arts Commission. You're on the Economic Development Commission, the Youth Advisory Commission. Is that right? Yep. And founder of Beats Lyrics Leaders and Kids of Palooza, and former school board member right here in Auburn, California. J. Ross Pirelli, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you so much, Sean. I appreciate everything you do. Thank you for being a voice, too. We really need your voice right now.
I have always been really impressed about all the different ways you connect to community. It's something that's in my heart, too. As you know, we've shared time on as school board members in adjacent foothills towns. And, I've always thought it was amazing that you could connect the work you do in the community with that higher level of actual elected service. Tell me a little bit about your time on the school board. I know you're not serving there now, but you know, what was it like for you to be on the school board in these times when school boards suddenly became the subject of national news?
What a great question and loaded question to start with. I would have to say first and foremost, the amount that I have learned being on the school board in the realm of education and advocacy was huge. So I happened to, in Placer County, start the first DEI statement for our Auburn Union School District. And upon receiving a new board, it was attempted to rescind the DEI statement. And that kind of started a whole 3-2 board. There were two of us that were very much deeply, deeply involved in the school system, volunteered on a regular basis, could tell you probably almost every child's name, if not every teacher's name, and really, really involved in what was going on with the community as far as families and students were concerned. Almost to call myself like a youth advocate. And when we had a big change and turning point in our board, it really became a 3-2. And I, the term battle comes to mind. I mean, it was really like an uphill battle to prove that showing up is what we have to do on the board. If you're going to make decisions for another human's child, you have to show up. You have to see the effect of those policies that you're making and changing, and you have to see the response that the children have to it. So I continuously asked our board members to show up, and I think in a way that might have angered them a little bit to the point where it became a little bit of a hostile environment. So by the time I left the school board, which was in December of 2024, it was a bittersweet leaving, right? So I still to this day volunteer in the classrooms, still hosting entrepreneurship academies in the classrooms, still a big part of the students. We have the Youth Advisory Council. So I never stopped that youth advocacy. I've just realized that my place is with the students and not in politics.
Yeah. And it's sad to me. I mean, what you just described there is politics, but I never in the 9 years I served on the school board of Placerville, never thought of what I was doing as politics, nor did my other board members. I mean, I did it leading up to the pandemic times and was just a few years before you. Right. And so in those times, it was just understood that we didn't bring our politics to the board. What we brought to the board was a deep respect for students and family, and that our mission was to do what we could with what we had for all the students and families in our district, period.
For us, it was hard to communicate. And if I could go back in hindsight, it would have been so great to have just training on different leadership styles and how we could communicate those styles together. We were a vast group, and had we been able to communicate, we could have done some great problem solving. So I think it really comes down to how do you communicate different leadership styles? And that was just something we couldn't get down.
And I think you've really hit upon the real tragedy of all this is when the adults who are tasked with this job of managing the schools, being a trustee, that's what you're actually called, a trustee, are incapable of doing that work because they brought something to that job that makes it so they can't communicate with others who are also tasked with that job, who are their co-equals. Then who suffers?
Well, so far, you know, we've had students leave our district. And I think there's a lot of changes, right? Like A plus B does not just always equal C. There's homeschool. There's a lot of stuff going on in education right now. But yeah, we've been in a very highly, this last round of politicians and our presidential campaign, like really allowed for a split rather than coming together and having conversation about opposing viewpoints.
Yeah. And, you know, you mentioned some of the wider issues. So one of the things that's going on right now, it's a national conversation. It's also happening in our state legislature at this very moment, is the notion that we ought to have vouchers so mm-hmm. that parents can send their students to any school they want, including private schools, including religious schools, including any school that they want to send their student to. What do you have an opinion on that? I mean, have you been following that?
I have been following it. And I think when it comes to taking, you know, it'd be different if there was a big pot of money and we could just be like, yes, everybody gets money. That's not how it's working right now. And when you look at something like education and you claim education to be the great equalizer, you have to have, and I'm sorry, this is such a buzzword, you have to have some sort of equity. If we're not coming in at the same point, you're never going to be equal. So when you talk about a voucher system that's trying to equalize a society, you can't do that without allowing other people to have what they need to get to that place of equalization. I feel like the people that are going to suffer are our most marginalized youth, our special education, the individuals that need that free lunch, individuals that have IEPs. I mean, these are the students that are going to suffer. And how is then schools it's no longer an equalizer.
Yeah. And you made a great point, which is our schools are chronically underfunded to begin with. So, you know, and they actually tried this in Arizona, just next door in Arizona. And what happened was, they thought that, oh, well, we're going to spend, you know, this amount of money and we're going to allow people to send their kids anywhere. What actually happened was the people who were already sending their kids to private schools who had the means to do that took advantage of the voucher system. They also used it to purchase educational opportunities like ski lift tickets, ski equipment, and many other luxury items, golf bags and, you know, memberships to golf clubs and, you know, which were all covered as part of the educational experience. And it literally bankrupted the Arizona government. And of course, what happens to, as you mentioned, you know, those are the students who already have every advantage walking into the school, right? They have parents who are probably more educated, have, you know, greater socioeconomic status. They've probably had more books in their home and more trips to faraway places that give them those rich experiences that will, you know, make them advance further in school when they're there. And so what happens to the kids who don't have that? There's actually now less money for them, less than they had before. Well, I don't want to get out of here without talking about all the other really cool stuff that you do. So tell me about Beats Lyrics Leaders. Is that what it is?
Beats Lyrics Leaders, yes.
Yes. Okay, cool. Yeah, tell me about that.
So Beats Lyrics Leaders, we create confidence and leadership through hip hop education and arts integrated entrepreneurship. Recently, we've combined forces with the city of Roseville to create a creative economy entrepreneurship initiative. So our main goal is that we focus on education and how can we help students be the best them that they could possibly be using creative forces. How do you tell your story? How do you get your story across? How do you advocate for your needs as a student? I'm sorry, if your mom is working 80 hours a week, it's really hard for her to advocate for you. So you have to be able to know what you need and how to advocate for that. So we are in classrooms all over California, from Orange County to, gosh, I want to say even up to Portland. We're working in Portland. We work on Native reservations, military academies, juvenile delinquency centers, and public schools. Recently, we signed a partnership with Sacramento County Office of Education, and I've been training artists to get into the classroom and teach arts integrated curriculum. So we work with all grade levels.
You know, that's now, my employer, right? I work at SCOE.
What? So SCOE, I'm doing a panel discussion on Monday with SCOE, if you're
no around. Way. Oh, sweet. that's amazing. I didn't even hear that. That's so cool. I love it.
It's been amazing. There's a program called Any Given Child. And I think with Prop 28, the idea to get arts into the hands of students was such a valuable experience for everybody. So we've been able to, and to me, arts education creates an innovative society, right? And then that led us to entrepreneurship, because now when you have innovation, you also have to be able to develop that, which led us into workforce development and workforce. So we are now, we're working with creatives of all types, students of all types. We have a comedy happy hour where we train comedians in entrepreneurship, and then we host venues so they can get paid, right? Because it's a creative economy. And we're doing this all throughout Placer County. We're working in Auburn Elementary is one of our piloted programs where we brought entrepreneurship and had 20 students, and we had 18 businesses. We had community involvement that came in and sponsored and gave money to these students so they can get the tools that they need to be successful. And it's just it's phenomenal. So that's a little, that's one part of what we do, but a big major part.
Yeah. I love it. Well, we're not going to get out of here without talking about Kidzapalooza. I want to know what that's all about and how that came to be and what you do with that.
Awesome. Kidzapalooza is fabulous. So when I first, it was right after COVID, I first jumped on the board and I thought, how can we celebrate our little people? Like, how can we show our little people that we love them? We're so happy to have families in the community. How do we drive them back into our schools? And I had hosted the first Kidzapalooza with the Auburn Recreation District. And so that looked like arts, music, and wellness. And they are free interactive booths and resources that are surrounding around Placer County. So I thought, how can I bring resources to the families if they need resource? How do they get access? Because that's our job, right? Our job is access, resources, and opportunities. That's what we have to provide to our community, especially as an elected official. So I called every resource I knew. I said, hey, can you do a booth, some kind of interactive fun booth with students so that parents can talk to you about any resources they may need? That allowed us to work with Placer County Human Services, Placer County Library, Lighthouse, First Five, Kids First, and all these incredible organizations that we have. Fast forward 4 years later, we now run two events. One is May 8th. At Regional Park, and one is September 11th at Recreation Park. They're free events for families. We have over 500 people show up, over 45 booths. It's all free. We have amazing sponsors. Dutch Bro usually gives us like coffee cards. And so kids that come in and do the bingo cards, they get coffee, well, hot chocolate cards. But it's all resource. It's all, how do we get access to the people that need it most? So we really can provide that next step, which would be equalization. Right. So, yeah.
So I see a through line here, like of all the things that you've done, how do you connect it in your head? Right. Like, I know that there is, you know what I mean? Is there like, was this a master plan or did it just sort of develop because you had this in your heart and in your, you know, in your spirit of what you wanted to do in life? I mean, what is the through line for you in all these things that you've talked about today?
I'm just going to be honest with you. I was like, how do I have a party with my friends? And let me tell you, my friends are all 10 and younger. Like, how do I have a big party with all my friends and homies and in the park? And that's how Kidzapalooza came to be. And I think at the bottom line is, I want my child to thrive. I want him to be in a community that is supportive, where he feels like he can be himself. And so I don't know if it came from a selfish point of like, well, we need to make sure that these 12-year-olds are going to be great mentors for my son. So let me start working with them. You know, I don't know exactly how it came to be, but I love what I do. I love it. These students are grateful. It's just phenomenal. Wherever we go, the whole goal is provide hope and confidence. Hope and confidence. And then what we want them to get out of it is to be able to tell their story and advocate. So that's kind of where it came from.
Wow. I love it. Well, I just want to say it's as always, it's great to have this conversation with you. I'm so amazed by all that you've managed to do and are continuing to do in our community for young people and for our community as a whole. Not many people wake up in the morning and think to themselves, I just want to do this thing and then just go out and create it from whole cloth. But you have. You really have. You've done.
It's amazing. We have an amazing community, and these students are everything. And again, just to full circle, let's say you can sit behind a table and make policies all you want, but unless you're there with these students interacting, I don't know how much of an influence you're ever going to have.
Anything else you want to say on the subject today before we wrap it up?
Nope, just super grateful. I'll see everybody May 8th at Regional Park for Kidzapalooza. And if anybody's interested in getting a hold of us or seeing any of our programs, if you want to check out what Beats Lyrics Leaders are doing or the Creative Economy Entrepreneurship Initiative, all of our entrepreneurship programs are donation-based, whatever you can afford. If you can't afford and you need to show up, show up. And you can find all of that information at beatslyricsleaders.com. So everything you need to know is on that page, and you can also get a hold of me through there. So anything I can do to help.
This episode of From the Roots Up is brought to you by The Torch Club, Sacramento's premier live music venue every Wednesday to Sunday. Check them out at 904 15th Street in Sacramento or online at torchclub.net. From the Roots Up is brought to you by The Six Pack. Crack open some change and support the candidates and causes we need in these times. Paid for by The Six Pack, which is responsible for the content of this advertising. www.thesixpack.com. Not authorized by any candidate or candidates committee. All right. Well, welcome back to From the Roots Up. And this is the part of the show I always look forward to. It's the part where we've sort of broken everything down, made you feel like, oh my gosh, what can I possibly do? And then we leave you with some things you can do. Today's topic is education, and I really want to drill in on some of the things you can do in your community to improve our public education system and really help provide greater advantage to our students and families in our community. The first thing you got to do, and it's, you know, pretty simple, but seldom done, is attend your school board meetings. Find out what your school board is like, what they prioritize, how they talk about things. And if you get there and you notice that discussions are all politically focused in one way or another, and I'm not talking about left or right, I'm just talking about what are they talking about? Is it how, you know, politics impacts their student? Is it, you know, I want parental rights and other people are saying, you know, I don't want DEI and I don't want CRT. And another group is talking about, you know, something else related to politics. If that's the conversation, make note about who's leading those conversations and really dig in and start calling them out. Because the bottom line is school board is a nonpartisan position. It is intended to be such because the whole mission is to oversee, to be a trustee of our public funds being used to serve students and families in our community. That is it. So any conversation that strays from those ideas of meeting student needs and student achievement and, you know, and family needs and family, you know, involvement in the schools, anything that strays beyond that is outside the scope of what should be happening on a school board and should be called out. And point out the good, you know, the most important thing is there are a lot of people who are just on the sidelines watching this who may not even have children in the school. So we need to remind those folks that there is a direct connection between quality schools, quality public schools, and the quality of a community. And that quality of a community is everything from what's happening out in the world to the value of property in those neighborhoods surrounding a school. So making sure that the schools are run in a fiscally sound manner, and run for the needs of students and families, guarantees that your community is going to be better. If we keep our focus on that, irrespective of our personal ideology, everybody wins. And so that's a great reason to just go to the school board. And then, you know, when you see things straying off of the into some other topic, what books are in the library, for example, bring it back and bring it back to how does this serve the needs of our students and families? You know, if we retain that focus, our schools will be better. If you see school board members who are just consistently incapable of talking about anything other than their ideological desires for the school district, it's time to get rid of them. And, you know, that means start really making that the focus. Organize, right? Find people who can run for school board and get rid of those folks who are really trying to politicize something that should not be politicized. If you can't find people to run, look around, first of all, find parents who are involved, who tend to be showing up to these things, find educators and retired educators and community leaders and encourage them to run. Because a lot of times, you know, it just never seemed possible to them. I was certainly one of those people. I never would have thought of being on a school board until I was asked to do it. And when I was asked and encouraged, I did it. And when I did it, I became good at it. And when I became good at it, I brought others to the school board who would do the same thing. And I brought parents into the various committees who cared about our community and our students and our families. And our school district thrived as a result of it. So, and if you can't, you know, find somebody, sometimes the person you're looking for is in the mirror. Consider it yourself. This is a public service that doesn't take an inordinate amount of your time, but one that is incredibly gratifying and incredibly important for decent people to take on. If you don't have time for all that, though, there are other ways you can get involved. Try and join one or more of the various committees that are mandated by state law to be at your school site, at your district. Join the budget committee. Join the site committee, which talks about, you know, what's happening at sites. Join the school safety committee if that's the thing that you're interested in. Or if you want to, you know, meet some of the students and families in your community who are, you know, recent arrivals, join the District English Language Learners Advisory Committee, the DLAC committee, and get to know those folks and hear from them about the needs of their students. You know, these are opportunities for you to engage. And again, it might be one meeting a month, sometimes one meeting, every couple of months. But it gives you a real understanding of what's happening in your school and an opportunity to make an impact in a very real way. And then if you don't have time for that, but you really want to do something directly good for students, go and volunteer at the schools. You know, pick a day that you can go and read and just read, you know, read to transitional kindergarten or kindergarten students or even first or second graders, right? Offer to help teachers out that way. Volunteer to start a club or an after-school activity that students can participate in. One of the reasons I ended up so involved in the school is I started an after-school filmmaking program because I was trained as a filmmaker. And I ran that program for 10 years. I never asked for a dime from the school district. Hundreds of students participated in that program. Some of them started in third grade and finished that program in eighth grade and, you know, had 5 or 6 years under their belt in that program, because I just had an idea and I went to the principal and I went to the teachers and I said, you know, would somebody provide me a classroom and supervision after school, you know, once a week to do this? And they did. And it was amazing. So it's often very easy if you have an idea to find people who are going to help you make that a thing that can happen and actually bring students and families into that. And then, you know, if you don't want to start a club or volunteer that way, go to the principal or if you have students there, ask the teacher, how can I get involved? What are the things I can do that would help you, would help our school, would help our most vulnerable students? And just get involved. Thank you for being with me this week on From the Roots Up. I hope you'll join me every week as we delve into a topic like this, and I hope you'll engage me in a conversation. If you want to reach out to us, send an email to fromtherootsupshow@gmail.com.